For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, Matthew chapter 7. Well, we've been working our way through Jesus' famous block of teaching called the Sermon on the Mount. And as we get into this passage tonight, we see that he still has plenty of fire left. We got a whole chapter to go on this. This is our seventh week. And this has been some dynamite stuff. Very, very applicable. If you remember, we've argued at several points that the key to understanding the Sermon on the Mount is you need to understand who Jesus is speaking against in this, what he's teaching against, and what he's been hammering on and what he continues to hammer on here in Matthew 7 is the prevailing religious mentality of the day, a mentality that was advocated by a group known as the Pharisees that we've talked about on several occasions. And, he brings up here in Matthew chapter 7, verse 1, he brings up a critique of them, probably his main critique that he's got of them, one that he's already brought up in a couple of different forms already, in the course of the last two chapters. He says in chapter 7, verse 1, "Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you." Pretty famous verse. A lot of people know this verse, especially a lot of non-Christians know this verse, I've noticed. I think part of it is because what a lot of non-Christians get from Christians is a real attitude of judgmentalism, self-righteous judgmentalism. And if there's one thing we pick up from the Pharisees, as we see the different accounts of them, it's this attitude right here, self-righteous judgmentalism. We read a parable a few weeks ago that Jesus told in Luke 18. I'll just read the introductory verse to that. It says, "Jesus also told this parable to some people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt." And so, he goes on to narrate this interaction where a Pharisee is heaping praise upon himself and also judgment and contempt upon this poor sinner over here who is so much worse than I am. I'm so much more righteous and holy than he is. And I think it's interesting here, the connection between self-righteousness, trusting in my righteousness, and viewing other people with contempt. Those two always seem to go together. You know, contempt naturally flows from self-righteousness. What self-righteousness says is, look at me, all by myself, I am so good, I always do the right thing, and if I don't, there's a really good reason why. It's someone else's fault. And God must be pretty happy with me. Part of the facade is this righteousness. It's a front that I have to keep up. Deep down, the arrogant person knows I don't have it all together. It's kind of a surprising fact. You know, if you get close to somebody that's pretty arrogant, you'll find that some of the most arrogant people are also some of the most insecure people. Now, I remember back in high school, people telling me how arrogant I was, and I was so confused because I'm thinking, you know, I'm like the most insecure person here in this entire room. I have a really low view of myself. How could you possibly think that I'm arrogant? It was like I couldn't even compete what they were saying. It was because I felt so bad about myself, I was constantly pushing other people down and showing other people, trying to validate myself before other people. And so this contempt, if you're insistent upon validating yourself and holding to your own righteousness, you're going to have to heap contempt on other people and take everyone down. It's like you're trying to lower the curve so that you, even though you know you're not 100%, you still are the top scorer in the class. It's interesting, too, this is always a selective comparison. It's always, I get to pick the areas where we're competing with one another. I get to judge everything. And, it's always areas that I am actually better than you in. And if I'm not, then I'll just switch to another area. And what Jesus is saying is, he's saying, if you want to play that game, you got to realize something. You know, here he says, if you want to heap self-righteous judgment on other people, then you're going to be judged in the same way. If you're holding other people to a standard of perfection, then God is going to hold you to that same standard. Remember, he's already said this a couple different ways, like in his teaching on the Lord's Prayer. At the end there, he said, if you want to be forgiven, you need to forgive other people completely and totally. And if you don't forgive other people, then God is not going to forgive you. And so you're going to be held to a standard of perfection. Or, you know, the quintessential statement at the end of Matthew 5, you need to be perfect like God is perfect. And so Jesus obviously does not think that anyone is perfect other than Jesus, other than himself. What he's saying here is if you want to play the self-righteousness game, then you got to understand what the stakes are. You know, the cutoff is not an 80% or a 90%. It's 100% perfect for your entire life. Thank God that he also is holding forth another way to come to God. You know, that's the punchline of that parable in Luke 18. Is the self-righteous person talking about how righteous he was, goes away unrighteous, but he says the sinner in that story, he was just coming before God and saying, God, please have mercy on me, I'm a sinner. That was the one that was declared righteous. That was the one that was forgiven. And that anyone that comes to God and admits they need a free gift, they need a handout of his forgiveness, he's offering that freely to anyone who's humble enough to admit they need it and to trust Jesus Christ. You see, Jesus Christ was perfect, and yet he died on a cross. And the reason he died on the cross is not because he was a criminal. It's because we're criminals. It's because we are wrongdoers, and we deserve the punishment that he took. And he's offering to stand in our place as our substitute if we're willing to admit that we need him to. And so he's trying to drive his audience, you know, to despair. He's trying to help them see how far short they fall and how badly they need God's forgiveness. He's trying to drive them to spiritual poverty, poor in spirit, like he started out this whole thing talking about. And so, you know, this whole idea of judging, he says, if you want to judge people by the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Not only is this, you know, it's a principle of law that he's teaching, our need for forgiveness. But, you know, he's not forbidding all judgment here, though. Okay, that's one thing we need to understand. You know, a lot of people will read this and they'll misunderstand what Jesus is saying, and they'll say, you're never allowed to say anything is wrong. And that's not at all what Christ is teaching here. What he's talking about is self-righteous judgmentalism. You know, like in John chapter 7, verse 24, he says, do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. He's actually commanding his disciples, you need to learn how to judge righteously, not judge according to appearances, but judge rightly. You know, there is such a thing as right and wrong. God has revealed his truth. And, you know, I think this is partly why some people have so much of a problem with this, is because in their minds, all morality is just defined by me. I come up with my own moral system. I decide what's right and wrong. And they can't understand why you would come up with a moral system that says that somebody else is wrong. And, you know, of course, when we come to Scripture, though, we're not the ones deciding what's right and wrong. We're basically a third-party observer. We can look at what God says, and we can look at the world around us, and we can try and figure out, does this fit with that or not? I can look at my own life. I can look at your life. I can just tell, does this match with what God says is right? And so we need to be able to distinguish between right and wrong, good and evil, truth and falsehood. That's really actually a pretty important part of this whole thing. You know, there's judgmentalism, which has a bad connotation. But, you know, if we say someone has good judgment, that usually has good connotations associated with it. And Jesus is saying you need to learn how to distinguish between right and wrong. He explicitly teaches this. Just a few verses later in this same chapter, Jesus says, beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ravenous wolves. You'll know them by their fruits. So he says, you've got to be able to distinguish between a sheep and a wolf wearing a sheep costume. You know, you need to be able to look, and he says, you know, there's going to be false teachers that are going to come in. We're going to talk about this passage more next week. False teachers are going to come in, and they're going to try to take and ravage the flock, the people that God has placed in your life. And you got to tell the difference here. You know, you need to be able to look and say, my, what big teeth you have. And he says, you'll know them by their fruits. You got to be able to discern this. That's an important that's an important skill that Jesus' followers need to have. 1 Corinthians 5:12, he says, it isn't my responsibility to judge outsiders, but it certainly is your responsibility to judge those inside the church who are sinning. Boy, this letter to this church at Corinth had a lot of problems. This is a letter that was written to them by the Apostle Paul. And, you know, this church was so confused and backward, they couldn't even tell which end was up. They couldn't tell right from wrong. You know, they had somebody in their church who was sleeping with his mom. Ugh. And, you know, they just felt like, wow, aren't we just such a gracious, tolerant community that we can accept something like this and still love somebody in this way? And Paul's like, come on. Even the non-Christians wouldn't stand for this. You guys know this is wrong. You got to be able to discern this, and you got to be able to take a stand with this and not let this go on any longer. He says, I'm not talking about judging the people outside the church. I'm talking about judging the people right here, like God did with everybody else. You need to deal with this community right here and now. He also says those who are spiritual can evaluate all things. Same root here. And so the ability to evaluate, the ability to discern, it's an important skill that we need to have. It's not teaching relativism or naivete, like I just can never say whether something's right or wrong. What he's saying here is it's a call for humility. You know, it's a call to take the other person out from under the microscope and maybe put my own life under there. And, you know, when I look a little more closely at myself, I start to realize I wouldn't, you know, I'm holding this person to a standard that I would never want to be applied to me. And there's a humility that comes from this. A softness that comes from this that will enable us to relate to other people in more of a loving way. If we have to push everybody down in order to prop ourselves up, that's going to yield really bad results. But if we understand how much forgiveness I've received, then it's going to totally change the standard that we apply to other people. So this is a call for humility here. Just a straight up call for humility. Now, there is another principle here too. And this is the principle of reciprocity, the issue of reciprocity in relationships. What do I mean by this? This is a term that often tends to come up in literature on, for example, marital counseling. It's the idea that people tend to reciprocate the behavior of others in their relationships. And so the way the other person is acting toward me, I tend to act the same way toward them. I tend to return, you know, it's like you're playing tennis and you're returning the volley back to them. And, sometimes you'll see two people or a whole group of people get stuck in these really negative relating patterns. And, you know, nobody can really remember who started it because it was started so long ago. We've really just been in this perpetual cycle of negativity. And nobody's willing to break the cycle because I'm just retaliating. I'm just responding to them in the way that they're responding to, that they're relating to me, but they're saying the same thing. This is what Jesus is talking about just a few verses later in Matthew 7:12. He says, this is the golden rule. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. You know, he's not saying do unto others as they do to you. He's also not teaching some sort of divine law of karma. That what goes around comes, you know, that there's some sort of universal accounting system and you're going to get back, like pay it forward, whatever you put in. No, he's saying you need to relate to other people. You need to do what's best for other people because that's what you would want people to do to you. And it shouldn't matter what they're doing to you. And so this reciprocity, this can work in a negative direction in a number of different ways. You know, we've already talked a little bit about judgmentalism. If you're in a relationship where you're constantly judging one another, even if it's not spoken judgment, that just casts a really negative pall on that relationship, or even a group of people where you're always criticizing and tearing one another down. You're judging one another. It's not the kind of environment where someone is going to be able to be open and vulnerable. Hostility. You know, some relationships are just characterized by flat-out meanness, and they don't even seem to notice it anymore. I know the group of friends I used to hang out with before I got involved in Christian community. It was just mean, you know, constantly taking shots at one another. It was real draining to be around. You know, you could get attacked at any moment. And I remember when I first got involved in with Christian community, how different it was. I remember this one time we were all standing around in the kitchen having some conversation, and I just randomly took this shot at somebody else who was standing right there. I think I made some sort of like, you know, joke about them being stupid. And, you know, everybody kind of gave, like, the awkward laugh. But I could tell this isn't that kind of place. And I felt a little bit ashamed, but even more than that, I felt a sense of relief. Like, thank God, I'm finally somewhere that I don't have to worry about getting attacked by someone who I thought was my friend. And so, you know, the hostility that we can have in our relationships, or, you know, when someone makes the joke that really is not funny, it really is just mean, we don't want that sort of pattern, that cycle developing in our relationships here. Sarcasm, the spirit of our age. You know, we just sit around making sarcastic jokes, taking sarcastic jabs at one another. It's like we're on some kind of sitcom episode where, you know, everybody is just so cool and laid back and clever and quick-witted. You know, imagine in an environment like that, you know, this person makes a sarcastic comment, this person makes a sarcastic jab, and then you say, hey, I've got something vulnerable I need to share here. I've got some sin I need to confess. Some encouragement to offer someone. It just wouldn't fit in an environment like that. It's like you come into a group, and maybe you're even in kind of a good mood, and then all of a sudden you just get torn down and brought down to the level that everybody else is on. Cynicism, closely related. This is just the belief that nothing's ever going to happen, nothing's going to work out, I'm sure everything's going to suck. That attitude is contagious. It's hard to have any hope. You feel pretty stupid for having hope. If you're, you know, relating to someone that's cynical, or if you're in a group of people where cynicism is running rampant, nobody believes in anybody, nobody's word means anything, nobody's going to follow through on their commitments. High expectations. If you come in with a critical spirit, I have trouble with this as well. Just very high expectations. Sometimes some things might meet my expectations, but most of the time I'm just communicating that you are not good enough. And it's really sad to see the effect that has on other people who want my approval. And, you know, that's not even really what I think deep down. I do really appreciate the person. I'm just not expressing it to them. And so when everybody has these high expectations, it leads to one of these critical, hostile atmospheres that we talked about earlier. Disengagement and ignoring. This one's a little different than the others, but just as bad. You know, where you're just, you know when the other person comes in the room, but I don't even acknowledge them. I'm just content to ignore the person. Sometimes this is a form of passive-aggressive anger. Disengagement, where, you know, there might be a few one-word answers if they ask me some questions, but for the most part, I'm just going to keep to myself. And when you're in that position, you can only ask so many questions and get one-word answers. You can only try so much. Eventually, you just kind of end up shutting down, too. And then pride. You know, in a group where everyone is conveying a kind of a one-upmanship, when you're just, everybody's got to show how great they are and how much better they are than everyone else. It's just a drain to be in a group like that, and it's a drain to be in a relationship like that. We're both so proud and stubborn that we can't actually even communicate with one another because we're too busy trying to save face and show that you're wrong and I'm right. On the other hand, this can go in a positive direction. There is such a thing as positive reciprocity, where I intentionally interact in a positive way and inject positive interactions into a situation. Consistent love investment. This is where, you know, I don't really care how the person responds, I'm going to continue to love them in this way. I'm going to continue to, maybe it's asking them questions and drawing them out. Maybe it's, you know, however that person feels loved, I'm going to keep doing that. And, you know, it might take a little while to get things going. But what you'll find is that over the long haul, that person will start, they'll start to melt. You know, this can be pretty frustrating if you're in a relationship that's disengaged or hostile or you're just alienated and you don't know what to do. The best thing you can do is to start to inject some positive love into that relationship or into that community. And slowly but surely, you'll start to see some pleasant results. Forgiveness, another big one. We're so reluctant to forgive one another. Some of us might have relationships where both of us are so bitter toward one another, and it's been that way for years. We're not willing to take the first step, or maybe the other person hurt us, they don't even know it. But it's just become this cold, disengaged relationship, and I'm just so bitter at them. If I'm willing to take the first step toward forgiveness, if I'm willing to release them from the debt that they're holding over me, if I'm willing to take captive my thoughts, my thoughts that they'll be injured in some way or that they'll just be embarrassed, if I'm willing to begin to serve them anyway, that breaks the cycle. A warm, enthusiastic affect. You know, there's certain people I know who, you know, when they show up, they just project this warmth, this attitude that says, I'm happy to be here, I'm happy to see you. They might even say that. And, you know, it doesn't take that much, but you end up walking away also feeling the same way. If you've got a group where everybody has this friendliness, this warmth to them, it's amazing. You know, you'll have Christians get together, and people will come into that group, and they will actually catch that same warmth, that same happiness. It's kind of a glow, even. That's something that people can pick up on, and they will then relate to other people in that way. Deeds of service, just doing nice things for people. You know, somebody... And I remember a roommate one time that the person had gone to work and they were working night shifts, so it was like midnight, and the person had forgotten their lunch that they bring with them. This person got out of bed, drove their lunch down to him, and even bought him a cup of coffee and gave it to him. And I just remember thinking to myself, I don't think I would do that to that person. And I felt humbled by the whole thing. I realized you're more mature than me. Affirmation and encouragement. This is one of the great ones. One of the greatest things we can do for one another is just to affirm one another, to encourage one another. I remember this experience we had about a year ago. You know, on Friday nights, me and a bunch of guys get together to study the Bible, and our group had grown pretty large. There's probably 20 guys there. And we got to the point where we needed to split into two different groups. And so this was our last night together as one group, and... you know, we took some communion, and we began to pray, and, you know, one of the guys there, just in his prayer, he started encouraging one of the other guys. And then other people began to jump in and thank God for this thing about this person, and thank God for this, the way this person has loved me, and thank God for this particular experience that I had with this person, and I thank you that the effect they've had in my life. And we began just to move on to different guys, and you know, periodically we would then turn back to God and thank Him, and you know, people were weeping. It was one of the most amazing times of prayer I've ever been a part of. You know, by the time we got to the end, we'd been going for 2 hours, and finally somebody just said amen because we were pretty exhausted emotionally. But what I saw there was the incredible power where you can get 20 guys together, and then one person begins to get this encouragement going. And then another and another. And if you've got people that are ready to serve in this way, that are ready to give out in this way, it is incredible the kind of community and the kind of atmosphere that you can experience. Easy to please. Again, this is one of the greatest things you can do for the people around you. If you're just easy to please. You're not constantly criticizing them. You're happy with the effort that they gave. And, you know, if they messed up, a lot of those can be overlooked. I know that person didn't mean that. We're giving people the benefit of the doubt. We're not demanding perfection in the way people relate to us. We're easy to please. And finally, appreciation for the relationship. Another great way we can love people around us. A great way we can take advantage of this reciprocity issue. You know, it's amazing how many people feel like a failure in their relationships. I'm amazed to admit how often I feel that. Like I'm just failing in this relationship. It makes me want to withdraw from the person. And if we can just express appreciation for that person, appreciation for that relationship, that goes such a long way. You maybe you can even think of times when people have done that for you. Why not turn around and do that for somebody else? Why not do unto others as you would have them do unto you? Why not take advantage of this principle that other people are often going to respond. Not always. We're not doing this with strings attached. We're not demanding. But we're certainly trying to inject some Christian love into the situation. And like I said, I think you'll be pretty pleased with the results that you get in your relationships on the whole over time with this sort of approach. Well, Jesus goes on. He says, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." Okay, so the Pharisees were the ultimate sin police. They actually believed, they believed that one of the main reasons why Rome was still politically in control of their country was because people were just not righteous enough. They believed that if we can just be more holy and more righteous, that God will finally free us from this Roman rule. So you can imagine the contempt that they would have had toward all these sinners who are causing our country to remain under Roman oppression. That just added fuel to their fire that was already burning pretty hot. You know, we like to think our sin is only a speck. You know, he's saying, okay, you might see sin in someone else's life. And to you, it probably looks like this huge plank, this huge log. And yeah, maybe I might have a little bit of sin. I'm certainly not perfect. I might even have a little bit of sin in this situation, but that's nothing compared to what they are doing to me, what they did to start this, how they overreacted to this little thing that I did and just made this thing so much worse. We like to think our sin is only a speck. It's so small you can barely see it. But what it does is it puts a plank-sized blind spot in our spiritual glasses. You know, it's like sunglasses that have a big old smudge mark on them. It's like it's kind of a small mark, but everywhere you look, it's just taking up most of your vision. It affects your ability to see things clearly. I mean, if you're wondering about this principle, why don't you just go and take some sawdust and pull your eyelid out and just shove it up under there and put your lid back down and then try and do anything. Get out your tweezers. Try and remove a splinter. I'll tell you what, though. I don't want you coming anywhere near my eye if you're in that condition. The eye is actually a pretty good analogy because it's kind of this sensitive thing. You don't want somebody messing with your eye under really any condition. I can barely let people put eye drops in my eye. It's just a sensitive part of my body, and especially when the other person has this sin that is so clearly out there. You know, our sin is kind of a sensitive thing. We want to hide that. It's making ourselves vulnerable. And we don't want other people to see that. We're embarrassed by it. Deep down, we kind of know that we messed up, and yet that just makes us all the more defensive about it. You know, Jesus says, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck. So this giant hunk of wood in your eye needs to be removed first, and then you'll be in more of a position where you can undergo this delicate operation. You know, he's not saying you can't remove the speck. We wouldn't want to go that far. We need to be able to restore one another. But this is a delicate operation. This is not something that we should undergo flippantly or harshly. I like how Galatians chapter 6 puts it. He says, "Brothers, if someone's caught in a sin, you who are spiritual should restore him gently. But watch yourself, or you too also may be tempted." And so, you know, I like the way he puts it here. He says, if someone is caught in a sin, I think that really captures the dynamics of sin. Where we're trapped by it. Jesus says anyone who sins is a slave to sin. We're caught like an animal in a trap that's desperately trying to get free. And most people, though, they don't want any help getting out of it. And he says the person that is in the restoration business, you who are spiritual, you're the ones that should get into this. The spiritually mature, they get into this and they do this gently. And they don't do it arrogantly, watching yourself lest you too be tempted. They do it with an attitude of humility. This very important work of trying to help other people in these areas. A couple of steps that we can take here in order to do this. This is one question we need to answer here. Who should initiate the humility? You're caught in this cycle where you're saying, you hurt me. You are wrong. And the other person says, you hurt me. You're the one that's wrong. Well, you're the one that started it. You are the one that started it. You always do this. I hate how you always wriggle off the hook. And then all of a sudden somebody steps in and they say, I was wrong. Who's going to be the one to do that? You know, a lot of the conflicts I get involved with, I'm just thinking, man, if that person would only admit they're wrong, this whole thing would be a whole lot easier. If they could just wake up to reality and see how right I am. Who should initiate the humility? Well, we saw in Galatians chapter 6, whoever's the most spiritually mature. So I guess you can decide who's more mature here and who's the bigger infantile brat. And if you're the bigger infant, then you just sit there and wait until the mature person finally initiates reconciliation. And not in a way like, well, since I am the most mature, I guess I got to do this. I definitely wouldn't say that to the other person. That's only escalating the conflict and revealing your immaturity, your unspirituality. No, you come in and you admit, I was wrong. And I need forgiveness, unqualified. This is kind of hard for some of us. We start to do it, and it's like, I was right. I was wrongly understood. It's hard to just say I was wrong. It's harder to think about saying it. Once you do it, it's surprising how much easier it is. You know, this is, it's actually kind of a relief. There's times where you get caught in a conflict and you just feel like there's no way out. You feel helpless. You know, there's been times where I've been in conflicts that were so severe. I actually thought to myself, now this is sick here, but I actually thought, I kind of wish I would get severely injured right now, like in a car wreck or something. And that way all this would be, you know, would be put behind us. You can feel that desperate in a conflict. And what Jesus is saying here is, you're not trapped. You're only trapped by your own pride. You're only trapped by your own self-righteousness that refuses to admit that you could have any problem in this situation, that you could have contributed in any way at all. That's what you're trapped by. And you need to be willing to admit, I was wrong. You need to be willing to tell the other person that. Not qualified, not, I'm sorry you misunderstood me. I'm sorry if you took it that way. It doesn't count. It's, you know, maybe you share some of your thought processes. I was just feeling real insecure, and I just responded really selfishly. There's no excuse for it. I'm sorry. You'd be amazed at the response that you'll get from the other person in that situation. You might need to ask God about this. You might need to ask God where you were wrong. Sometimes it can be so terrifying to admit that I'm wrong. There might be people in this room that have never admitted that they're wrong. You also might know people who you've never heard apologize for anything. Maybe a parent, maybe a boss, whatever. You might need to ask God. This is a scary thing. I heard a guy describe this a few weeks ago as the law of inverse rationality, where the closer you get to the sin issues in your life, especially the ones that run the deepest, the more irrational you get in defending yourself and in shifting the blame and in coming up with any excuse possible to not have this pinned on me. Again, it's my pride. So we can ask God, how have I possibly made this worse? I think this is a pretty good question to ask, because you're not saying, how did I make this worse? Because sometimes it's hard to admit that I actually did that. And even, how did I probably contribute to this? Sometimes it's hard that. You just need to go with the brainstorming phase. What are some possible ways that I could have possibly made this worse? In my deeds, in the things that I did. You know, the way that I lashed, the way that I... maybe it was my laziness that contributed to this whole thing. Maybe it was my rebellious attitude toward them. You know, in my thoughts. Maybe I was judging their motives. Maybe I was harboring a critical spirit toward them. in my attitude? You know, was I taking a really exacting approach here? Was I taking that hard to please line that I was talking about earlier? You know, where I technically didn't do anything wrong, yet my whole attitude, my whole demeanor is the kind of thing where if they were treating me that way, I think I'd respond the same way. And so we got to ask ourselves, have I made this worse in any way? Well, that's a good start on the plank in your own eye. You're on your way toward being a qualified speck remover. Once you can admit your own sin in the matter. The other person, they're not going to be able to trust you until you're willing to show them, yeah, I understand grace. I understand it enough that I can apply it to my own life. He goes on, though. He says, you know, we do want to be in the business of speck removal, but at the same time, he says, do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. And so the image that he's giving here is, you know, you've got some sort of really valuable gem or a pearl, some sort of valuable stone, and going up to a wild pig and saying, here, piggy, 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 and just kind of tossing these at him. He's like, they don't know what a pearl is. They don't understand that that's valuable. All they see is some stranger is coming at me, and he's throwing something at me. He's assaulting me in some way. He says, you'll probably trigger their self-defense mechanism. They'll run right over those pearls, right over you, and maybe gore you to death, turn and tear you into pieces. What is he talking about here? Well, Jesus knew that his followers would soon be under persecution. He knew. He warned them several times about this. He knew that the religious in this society would quickly turn murderous. He knew the Pharisees were going to kill him. He knew they were going to kill a lot of his disciples as well. That's why he warned them that, you know, if they hated me, they're going to hate you. If they persecute me, they're definitely going to persecute you. You know, the religious leaders, the Pharisees, did not like the message that Jesus was bringing to them. And it was so painful on their self-righteous ears. The idea that you're actually not good enough. That for all of your posturing, for all of your acting, for all of your facade, I see right through you, God sees right through you, and you've got a major problem with him. God is not appreciative of your righteousness. He's offended by it. He's appalled that you would think that you are on par with him, that you'd have some sort of right to waltz into heaven. No way. And, you know, you hear that message enough. And they got angry enough. Their power, their wealth was threatened, and they came after him. They took him down. They killed him. He knew that would be the case. This is why throughout a lot of his ministry, you know, he's interacting with the religious leaders from time to time, but for the most part, he's saying, keep this down. You know, this thing I did, this thing I told you, don't tell anybody about this. He's kind of keeping it under wraps until he gets to the point in his ministry where he's ready to die. And that's when he winds up and throws his most furious pitches right at them. And so he's warning them here. There's a lot of people that aren't going to like to hear the things that I'm teaching you. And you got to understand that. You got to be able to distinguish between somebody that actually wants to listen and a pig or a dog. But I think, you know, another issue that this does bring up is the issue of boundaries. The issue of boundaries. We've got to accept our limitations. No matter how nicely we package the message, no matter how much we plead with the person, no matter how much we love the person, no matter how much we serve this person, no matter how clever our arguments are, no matter how persuasive we are, there's some cases where we've just got to understand, I'm just a human being, and I cannot overpower this person's free will. You know, people make free choices. It's frustrating sometimes to see someone make a choice that is so painful. It's almost like you're more bothered by how it's damaging them than they are. That's hard. You wish you could break through to them, but it's like every time you try and talk, the defenses go up. What you've got to understand is that even God, the perfect Father, has had quite a few of his kids rebel against him, including the first ones living in a state of perfection. And so in spite of all of our best efforts, we got to understand these are people that we're dealing with. And we cannot force them to listen. We cannot force them to accept the valuable gifts that we're handing to them. They take it as hostility and they turn on us. We got to respect refusal. If someone refuses, if we're telling them about Jesus, if we're telling them about the message of grace and they don't want it, and they continue to reject it, we got to respect that. We got to respect the person's choice. Not that we never talk to them again, but we got to understand they may not be ready to hear this right now. Jesus says to his disciples later when he sends them out for their first round of preaching, he says, if somebody won't accept you, just move on, okay? There's too much to do here. You got to find the responsive people. There's people out there that really do want to hear this. I guarantee it. He's like, I know there's people out there that will respond to this. You got to go out there and find them. Got to find the responsive. And you got to remember, too, that prayer is still effective. We continue to pray for people. We're not giving up easily, but at the same time, at a certain point, we're moving on and then circling back around later while we continue to pray for them. Sometimes people are just not ready yet. They got to go out. They got to see how terrible their own ways are, how painful those are. And then, that kind of softens them up. It starts to create a thirst for real answers. And, a year from now, when they've damaged themselves a lot more than they already have, maybe then they'll start to feel ready for some hope, ready for some answers. Sometimes you just alienate the relationship even more by continuing to press on this. There maybe needs to be a time in our relationships where we just decide to drop that issue. We stop trying to track the other person down on that particular point or whatever. Maybe at some point they're going to be ready for that. But, we can't force ourselves and we can't force truth on people. And sometimes it can get pretty dangerous and destructive if we try to do that. Part of this is we're taking our identity from how the other person responds to us. It's like, I must break through to this person in order for me to be complete. And God says, no, that's not why you matter. You matter, if you're a Christian, you matter because you're my son or you're my daughter. And that's really what he gets into next here, is he gets into how our pride will affect our relationship with him. So we'll just read these last few verses before drawing some conclusions. He says, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. And the sense here is not just one time, but it's a continual. Keep on asking, keep on seeking, keep on knocking. He says, everyone who asks receives, he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks, the door will be opened. Which of you, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? He says, if you then, though you're evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? So he's drawing an analogy here. He's calling on us to ask, to seek, to knock, to make our requests known to God. And he says, do you understand the kind of God that you're dealing with? Your heavenly Father? Even you earthly fathers, you know how to love your kids. If your kid asks for a piece of bread, you don't take a stone and wrap some bread around it and give it to him and then laugh when he breaks his teeth on it. You don't hand him a bag, tell him there's a fish in it, and then have a viper leap out and bite him on the hand and then just laugh and point. No. He's like, even you, evil people, know how to do good things. You guys do bad things all the time, but you know how to love your kids. Why would your heavenly Father not be at least as good as you, and actually way, way better, way more loving than you could ever dream of being? The self-righteous mindset does not view God as generous in giving. They view God as a very stingy being, a very angry being, one who is constantly disappointed, and, who might throw a lump of coal in your stocking, but other than that, you've been naughty this year and you don't get any gifts. The whole religious mindset, it's centered around earning and demanding things from God. It's like, if I haven't worked for it, then why would God give that to me? It's completely the opposite of grace. God says, I am not like that. I'm a father that loves his kids. And you need to come to me to ask. You know, ultimately, we got to understand God is eager to reveal himself to you. I think that's at the heart of what he's saying here. If you're actually seeking God, truly seeking him, he will reveal himself to you. You know, some people are afraid to even ask God if he's there. And, you know, the response that the reason they give is, well, what if I ask and God doesn't answer? I think the real reason is, what if I ask and God does answer? What might that mean for my life? God is eager to reveal himself to you, and he paid the ultimate price so that he could have a relationship, so you could have a relationship with him. He paid for your forgiveness. Also, God is eager to provide the security that you need to love other people. We need to understand that if you are a Christian, you have been adopted and forgiven. You're not an orphan anymore. You're God's child. And instead of having to grasp around at the people around you to try to gain some sense of identity or self-worth, we need to understand God has already given that to me. Regardless of what I do, regardless of how I perform, regardless of how many times I mess up, God loves me. He's my dad. He's a good dad. And he knows that I'm going to make mistakes. He wants to provide you the security that you need to do all of the things that he's been talking about really throughout this sermon, but especially the things he's been talking about here just now. These relational commands that he's calling them to do. And God is eager to provide the power that you need to love other people, the strength. You know, out of that secure relationship, then the strength and the endurance to continue to love other people, the ability to open up your heart, even after you've been hurt again, the ability to be vulnerable, not like a lot of people in the world where when you get hurt, you close yourself off and you vow, I will never ever allow myself to get hurt again. And that leads to a life of loneliness and depression where, you know, if you won't allow yourself to get hurt, you also can't experience love. You know, that's the same set of doors that you got to open or bolt shut. God gives you the courage to step out again. He gives you the ability to forgive other people based on his forgiveness. God is the only one that can make any of this relating that he's talking about here possible. He is the source. And without him, you will never succeed at this. This is not something you can try on your own. I mean, you can try. This is not something you can accomplish on your own. And so he says, in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. This sums up the law and the prophets. You know, really a summary of most of what has come so far in this sermon. And as we can see, like we saw in Matthew 5, this all funnels down into love. The greatest commandment and the thing that sums up all of God's will for my life. The command to love him and to love one another. That's what he's talking about here, the golden rule. So a couple of conclusions we can draw from this. One, humility begins with letting God meet your deepest needs. If you ever want to overcome your self-righteousness and your pride and all of the other negative relating strategies that flow from that, you've got to come to God. He's the only one that can provide true forgiveness and complete forgiveness. And he's the only one that can meet all the other needs in your life for security, for acceptance, for a sense of belonging, for a sense of worth, and also for power over death, for your eternal destiny. God has the answers, the solutions to all of these. But you've got to come to him and admit your complete need for that. Your greatest need is to be forgiven and adopted. This is what you need. You're alone and you'll continue to be alone until you come, and you're guilty and you'll continue to be guilty until you come to God and experience and accept his forgiveness and also become adopted into his family. You know, instead of like an orphan scavenging the streets, begging for money, stealing things when I can, we've got a heavenly Father who's looking out for us, who loves us. And this alone will enable you to truly love other people. This humility, this is the only thing that can unlock the negative patterns that have built up, your inability to take responsibility for the problems in your relationships, and the ability to just boldly step forward, to admit wrong, to love the other person, to not worry so much about what am I getting back here, but to be filled with the love of God, and then in turn, to give that love out to other people. That's the message of Matthew 7, 1 through 12. We got one more study here in the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to finish the rest of this chapter off next week. It's a pretty offensive passage. Jesus says there's two ways, and the right way and the wrong way. It's quite black and white. I hope you'll come back and join us for this really radical, offensive teaching from Jesus. Yeah, Lord, it is pretty amazing how generous you are, that you're not at all what we think you're going to be. You're not the kind of God that just reacts to our rejection of you, Lord, but you just love us even more. You pursue us even more as we run from you, God. Thank you that you're always there. You're not holding a grudge. You're not unwilling to accept us when we turn back to you. And I thank you, Lord, that you give us the kind of security, the kind of love that we need to begin to build deep relationships here on earth. God, thank you that we're in a community where we're not judging one another, where we are characterized to a large degree by openness and transparency and humility. I pray we wouldn't take that for granted, God. I pray we would never become a self-righteous, judging, disengaged community. And I pray that we would not sit around waiting for other people to take the first step toward humility, Lord. Take the first step toward service, the first step toward initiation. But that we would see this as something you're calling us to do right now, right here, to step up as a servant leader. And I pray that as more and more of us do that, that more and more people would catch on. And that it would become an even more awesome place to be. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.